Chapter 28. General feeling seems to be that it's a blessing Mr. Crookward made away with first, mingled with a little natural disappointment that he was not. In the midst of this sensation, the beetle arrives. The beetle, though generally understood in the neighborhood to be a ridiculous institution, is not without a certain popularity for the moment, if it were only as a man who is going to see the body. The policeman considers him an imbecile civilian, a remnant of the barbarous watchman times, but gives him admission as something that must be borne with until government shall abolish him. The sensation is heightened as the tidings spread from mouth to mouth that the beetle is on the ground and has gone in. By and by the beetle comes out, once more intensifying the sensation, which has rather languished in the interval. He is understood to be in want of witnesses for the inquest tomorrow who can tell the coroner and jury anything whatever respecting the deceased. Is immediately referred to innumerable people who can tell nothing whatever. Is made more imbecile by being constantly informed that Mrs. Green's son was a law writer himself, and knowed him better than anybody, which son of Mrs. Green's appears, on inquiry, to be at the present time aboard a vessel bound for China, 3 months out, but considered accessible by telegraph on application to the Lords of the Admiralty. Beetle goes into various shops and parlors, examining the inhabitants, always shutting the door first, and by exclusion, delay, and general idiocy exasperating the public. Policemen seem to smile to potboy. Public loses interest and undergoes reaction. Taunts the beetle in shrill youthful voices with having boiled a boy, choruses fragments of a popular song to that effect and importing that the boy was made into soup for the workhouse. Policeman at last finds it necessary to support the law, and sees a vocalist, who is released upon the flight of the rest on condition of his getting out of this then, come, and cutting it a condition he immediately observes. So the sensation dies off for the time, and the unmoved policeman, to whom a little opium, more or less, is nothing, with his shining hat, stiff stock, inflexible greatcoat, stout belt and bracelet, and all things fitting, pursues his lounging way with a heavy tread, beating the palms of his white gloves one against the other and stopping now and then at a street corner to look casually about for anything between a lost child and a murder. Under cover of the night, the feeble-minded beetle comes flitting about Chancery Lane with his summonses, in which every juror's name is wrongly spelt, and nothing rightly spelt, but the beetle's own name, which nobody can read, or wants to know. The summons is served and his witnesses forewarned. The beetle goes to Mr. Crooks, to keep a small appointment he has made with certain paupers, who, presently arriving, are conducted upstairs, where they leave the great eyes in the shutter something new to stare at, in that last shape which earthly lodgings take for no one and for everyone. And all that night the coffin stands ready by the old portmanteau, and the lonely figure on the bed, whose path in life has lain through 45 years, lies there with no more track behind him that anyone can trace than a deserted infant. Next day the court is all alive as like a fair, as Mrs. Perkins, more than reconciled to Mrs. Piper, says in amicable conversation with that excellent woman. The coroner is to sit in the first floor room at the Soul's Arms, where the harmonic meetings take place twice a week, and where the chair is filled by a gentleman of professional celebrity, faced by Little Swills, the comic vocalist, who hopes, according to the bill in the window, that his friends will rally round him, and support first-rate talent. The Soul's Arms does a brisk stroke of business all the morning. Even children so require sustaining under the general excitement, that a pieman who has established himself for the occasion at the corner of the court, says his brandy balls go off like smoke. What time the beetle, hovering between the door of Mr. Crook's establishment, and the door of the Soul's Arms, shows the curiosity in his keeping to a few discreet spirits and accepts the compliment of a glass of ale or so in return. At the appointed hour arrives the coroner, for whom the jurymen are waiting, and who is received with a salute of skittles from the good dry skittle ground attached to the soul's arms. The coroner frequents more public houses than any man alive. The smell of sawdust, beer, tobacco smoke, and spirits is inseparable in his vocation from death in its most awful shapes. He is conducted by the beadle and the landlord to the harmonic meeting room, where he puts his hat on the piano and takes a Windsor chair at the head of a long table formed of several short tables put together and ornamented with glutinous rings in endless involutions, made by pots and glasses. As many of the jury as can crowd together at the table sit there. The rest get among the spittoons, and pipes are lean against the piano. Over the coroner's head is a small iron garland, the pendant handle of a bell, which rather gives the majesty of the court the appearance of going to be hanged presently. Call over and swear the jury. While the ceremony is in progress, sensation is created by the entrance of a chubby little man in a large shirt collar, with a moist eye and an inflamed nose, who modestly takes a position near the door as one of the general public, but seems familiar with the room too. A whisper circulates that this is Little Swills. It is considered not unlikely that he will get up an imitation of the coroner and make it the principal feature of the harmonic meeting in the evening. Well, gentlemen, the coroner begins. Silence there, will you? Says the beadle. Not to the coroner, though it might appear so. Well, gentlemen, resumes the coroner. You are impaneled here to inquire into the death of a certain man. Evidence will be given before you as to the circumstances attending that death, and you will give your verdict according to the skittles. They must be stopped, you know, beadle, evidence, and not according to anything else. The first thing to be done is to view the body. Make way there, cries the beadle. So they go out in a loose procession, something after the manner of a straggling funeral, and make their inspection in Mr. Crook's back second floor, from which a few of the jurymen retire pale and precipitately. The beadle is very careful that two gentlemen not very neat about the cuffs and buttons, for whose accommodation he has provided a special little table near the coroner in the harmonic meeting room, should see all that is to be seen. For they are the public chroniclers of such inquiries by the line, and he is not superior to the universal human infirmity, but hopes to read in print what Mooney, the active and intelligent beadle of the district, said and did, and even aspires to see the name of Mooney as familiarly and patronizingly mentioned as the name of the hangman is, according to the latest examples. Little Swills is waiting for the coroner and jury on their return. Mr. Tulkinghorn, also. Mr. Tulkinghorn is received with distinction, unseated near the coroner between that high judicial officer, a bagatelle board, and the coal box. The inquiry proceeds. The jury learn how the subject of their inquiry died, and learn no more about him. A very eminent solicitor is in attendance. Gentlemen, says the coroner, who, I am informed, was accidentally present when discovery of the death was made, but he could only repeat the evidence you have already heard from the surgeon, the landlord, the lodger, and the law stationer, and it is not necessary to trouble him. Is anybody in attendance who knows anything more? Mrs. Piper pushed forward by Mrs. Perkins. Mrs. Piper sworn. Anastasia Piper, gentleman. Married woman. Now, Mrs. Piper, what have you got to say about this? Why, Mrs. Piper has a good deal to say, chiefly in parentheses and without punctuation, but not much to tell. Mrs. Piper lives in the court which her husband is a cabinet maker, and it has long been well beckoning among the neighbors, counting from the day next, but one before the half-baptizing of Alexander James Piper aged 18 months, and 4 days old on accounts of not being expected to live, such was the sufferings, gentlemen, of that child in his gums, as the plaintiff, so Mrs. Piper insists on calling the deceased, was reported to have sold himself. Thinks it was the plaintiff's heir in which that report originated. See the plaintiff often, and considered as his heir was furious, and not to be allowed to go about some children being timid, and if doubted, hoping Mrs. Perkins may be brought forward, for she is here, and will do credit to her husband and herself and family, has seen the plaintive wexed and worded by the children, for children they will ever be, and you cannot expect them specially, if of playful dispositions, to be methuselers which you was not yourself, on accounts of this and his dark looks has often dreamed as she see him take a pickaxe from his pocket, and split Johnny's head, which the child knows not fear, and has repeatedly called after him close at his heels, never however see the plaintiff take a pickaxe, or any other weapon far from it. Has seen him hurry away, when run and called after, as if not partial to children, and never see him speak to neither child, nor grown person at any time, excepting the boy, that sweeps the crossing down the lane over the way round the corner which, if he was here would tell you, that he has been seen a speaking to him frequent. Says the coroner, is that boy here? Says the beadle, no, sir, he is not here. Says the coroner, go and fetch him then. In the absence of the active and intelligent, the coroner converses with Mr. Tulkinghorn. Oh! Here's the boy, gentlemen. Here he is, very muddy, very hoarse, very ragged. Now, boy! But stop a minute. Caution! This boy must be put through a few preliminary paces. Name, Joe. Nothing else that he knows on. Don't know that everybody has two names. Never heard of such a thing. Don't know that Joe is short for a longer name. Thinks it long enough for him. He don't find no fault with it. Spell it? No. He can't spell it. No father, no mother, no friends. Never been to school. What's home? Knows a broom's a broom, and knows it's wicked to tell a lie. Don't recollect who told him about the broom, or about the lie, but knows both. Can't exactly say what'll be done to him arter he's dead, if he tells a lie to the gentleman here, but believes it'll be something worry bad to punish him, and serve him right, and so he'll tell the truth. This won't do, gentlemen, says the coroner with a melancholy shake of the head. Don't you think you can receive his evidence, sir? Asks an attentive juryman. Out of the question, says the coroner. You have heard the boy. Can't exactly say won't do, you know. We can't take that in a court of justice, gentlemen. It's terrible depravity. Put the boy aside. Boy put aside, to the great edification of the audience, especially of Little Swills, the comic vocalist. Now, is there any other witness? No other witness. Very well, gentlemen. Here's a man unknown. Proved to have been in the habit of taking opium in large quantities for a year and a half, found dead of too much opium. If you think you have any evidence to lead you to the conclusion that he committed suicide, you will come to that conclusion. If you think it is a case of accidental death, you will find a verdict accordingly. Verdict accordingly. Accidental death. No doubt. Gentlemen, you are discharged. Good afternoon. While the coroner buttons his great coat, Mr. Tulkinghorn and he give private audience to the rejected witness in a corner. That graceless creature only knows that the dead man, whom he recognized just now by his yellow face and black hair, was sometimes hooted and pursued about the streets. That one cold winter night when he, the boy, was shivering in a doorway near his crossing, the man turned to look at him, and came back, and having questioned him, and found that he had not a friend in the world, said, neither have I. Not one. And gave him the price of a supper and a night's lodging. That the man had often spoken to him since, and asked him whether he slept sound at night, and how he bore cold and hunger, and whether he ever wished to die, and similar strange questions. That when the man had no money, he would say in passing, I am as poor as you today, Joe, but that when he had any, he had always, as the boy most heartily believes, been glad to give him some. He was worry good to me, says the boy, wiping his eyes with his wretched sleeve. When I see him a layin' so stretched out just now, I wished he could have heard me tell him so. He was worried good to me, he was. As he shuffles downstairs, Mr. Snagsby, lying in wait for him, puts a half crown in his hand. If he'll ever see me coming past your crossing with my little woman, I mean a lady, says Mr. Snagsby with his finger on his nose, don't allude to it. For some little time the jurymen hang about the soul's arms colloquially. In the sequel, half a dozen are caught up in a cloud of pipe smoke that pervades the parlor of the soul's arms. Two stroll to Hampstead, and four engage to go half price to the play at night, and top up with oysters. Little Swills is treated on several hands. Being asked what he thinks of the proceedings, characterizes them, his strength lying in a slangular direction, as a rummy start. The landlord of the Soul's Arms, finding Little Swills so popular, commends him highly to the jurymen and public, observing that for a song in character he don't know his equal, and that that man's character wardrobe would fill a cart. Thus, gradually the Soul's Arms melts into the shadowy night, and then flares out of it strong in gas. The harmonic meeting hour arriving, the gentleman of professional celebrity takes the chair, is faced, red-faced, by Little Swills. Their friends rally round them, and support first-rate talent. In the zenith of the evening, Little Swills says, gentlemen, if you will permit me, I'll attempt a short description of a scene of real life that came off here today. Is much applauded and encouraged. Goes out of the room as Swills. Comes in as the coroner, not the least in the world like him, describes the inquest, with recreative intervals of pianoforte accompaniment, to the refrain. With his, the coroner's, tippy-toll-e-doll, tippy-toll-o-doll, tippy-toll-e-doll, d. The jingling piano at last is silent, and the harmonic friends rally round their pillows. Then there is rest around the lonely figure, now laid in its last earthly habitation. And it is watched by the gaunt eyes, in the shutters through some quiet hours of night. If this forlorn man could have been prophetically seen lying here by the mother at whose breast he nestled, a little child, with eyes upraised to her loving face, and soft hand scarcely knowing how to close upon the neck to which it crept, what an impossibility the vision would have seemed. Oh, if in brighter days the now extinguished fire within him ever burned for one woman who held him in her heart, where is she, while these ashes are above the ground? It is anything but a night of rest at Mr. Snagsby's, in Cook's Court, where Guster murders sleep by going, as Mr. Snagsby himself allows not to put too fine a point upon it out of one fit in 220. The occasion of this seizure is that Guster has a tender heart, and a susceptible something that possibly might have been imagination, but for Tooting, and her patron saint. Be it what it may, now, it was so direfully impressed at tea time by Mr. Snagsby's account of the inquiry at which he had assisted that at supper time she projected herself into the kitchen, preceded by a flying Dutch cheese, and fell into a fit of unusual duration, which she only came out of to go into another, and another, and so on through a chain of fits, with short intervals between, of which she has pathetically availed herself, by consuming them in entreaties to Mrs. Snagsby, not to give her warning when she quite comes to, and also in appeals to the whole establishment to lay her down on the stones, and go to bed. Hence, Mr. Snagsby, at last hearing the cock at the little Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.